You're fast. Lana's in her own mind, red and dense with obsession. We riding where? She clutches the flip-down mirror with both hands. I can tell by her voice that she is smiling, or at least gritting her teeth. He's gonna kill my sister, Mama. You sound like you're flailing down a river. I know, Carl. It's for real this time. You hear me, Ma? Lan rocks side to side from the mirror, making whooshing sounds. We getting out of here, huh? We gotta go far, little dog. Outside, the night surges by like sideways gravity. The green numbers on the dash read 304. Who put my hands in my face? The tires squeal at each turn. The streets are empty, and it feels like a universe in here. In everything, hurling through the cosmic dark, while in the front seat, the women who raised me are losing their minds. Through my fingers, the night is black construction paper. Only the frazzled heads of these two before me are clear, swaying. Don't worry, Mai. You're speaking to yourself now. Your face so close to the windshield, the glass fogs a ring that spreads in equal measure to your words. I'm coming. We're coming. After a while, we swerve down the street, lined with Continentals. The car crawls, then stops in front of a gray, clabbered townhouse. Mai, you say, pulling the emergency brake. He's gonna kill Mai. Lan, who all this time had been shaking her head from side to side, stops, as if the words have finally touched a little button inside her. What? Who kill who? Who died this time? Both of you stay in the car. You unbuckle your belt, leap out, and shuffle toward the house, the door left open behind you. There's a story Lan would tell, of Lady Jiu, the mythical woman warrior who led an army of men and repelled the Chinese invasion of ancient Vietnam. I think of her, seeing you. How, as legend goes, armed with two swords, she'd fling her yard-long breasts over her shoulders and cut down the invaders by the dozens. How it was a woman who saved us. Who die now? Lan swings around, her face, made stark by the overhead light, ripples with this new knowledge. Who gonna die, little dog? She flips her hand back and forth, as if opening a locked door to indicate emptiness. Somebody kill you? For what? But I'm not listening. I'm rolling down the window, arms burning with each turn on the handle. Cool November air slips in. My stomach grabs as I watch you mount the front steps, the 9-inch machete glinting in your hand. You knock on the door, shouting. Come out, Carl, you say in Vietnamese. Come out, you fucker. I'm taking her home for good. You can have the car, just give me my sister. At the word sister, your voice cracks into a short, busted sob before regaining control. You bash the door with the machete's wooden butt. The porch lights turn on, your pink nightgown suddenly green under the fluorescent. The door opens. You step back. A man appears. He half lunges from the doorway as you backpedal down the steps, the blade locked at your side as if pinned in place. He has a gun, Lan whisper shouts from the car, now lucid. Rose, it's a shotgun. It shoots two eaters at once. They eat your lungs inside out. Little dog, tell her. Your hands float over your head. The metal clanks on the driveway. The man, huge, his shoulders sloped under a gray Yankee sweatshirt, steps up to you, says a few words through his teeth, then kicks the machete to the side. It disappears in the grass with a flash. You mumble something, make yourself small, cup your hands under your chin, the posture you take after receiving a tip at the salon. The man lowers his gun as you back away, shaking, toward the car. It's not worth it, Rose, Lan says, cupping her mouth with both hands. You can't beat a gun. You just can't. Come back. Come back in the helicopter. Ma, I hear myself say, my voice cracking. Ma, come on. You edge slowly into the driver's seat, turn to me with a nauseated stare. There's a long silence. I think you're about to laugh, but then your eyes fill. So I turn away, to the man carefully eyeing us, hand on his hip, the gun clamped between his armpit, pointed at the ground, protecting his family. When you start to talk, your voice is scraped out. I catch only parts of it. It's not Mai's house, you explain, fumbling with your keys. Or rather, Mai is no longer there. The boyfriend, Carl, who used to slam her head against the wall, is no longer there. This is somebody else. White man with a shotgun and a bald head. It was a mistake, you're saying to Lan. An accident. But Mai has not lived here for 5 years, Lan says with sudden tenderness. Rose. Although I don't see it, I can tell she's brushing your hair behind your ear. Mai moved to Florida, remember? To open her own salon. Lan is poised, her shoulders relaxed. Someone else has stepped inside her and started moving her limbs, her lips. We go home. You need sleep, Rose. The engine starts. The car lurches into a U-turn. As we pull away from the porch, a boy, no older than I am, points a toy pistol at us. The gun jumps and his mouth makes blasting noises. His father turns to yell at him. He shoots once, two more times. From the window of my helicopter, I look at him. I look him dead in the eyes and do what you do. I refuse to die. Part 2. Memory is a choice. You said that once, with your back to me, the way a god would say it. But if you were a god, you would see them. You would look down at this grove of pines, the fresh tips flared lucent at each treetop, tender damp in their late autumn flush. You would look past the branches, past the rusted light splintered through the brambles, the needles falling one by one as you lay your god eyes on them. You trace the needles as they hurled themselves past the lowest bough, toward the cooling forest floor, to land on the two boys lying side by side, the blood already dry on their cheeks. Although it covers both their faces, the blood belongs to the tall boy, the one with eyes the dark gray of a river beneath somebody's shadow. What's left of November seeps through their jeans, their thin-knit sweaters. If you were God, you'd notice that they're staring up at you. They're clapping and singing This Little Light of Mine, the Ralph Stanley version they'd listened to earlier in the afternoon on the tall boy's stereo. It was his old man's favorite song, the tall boy had said. And so now their heads sway side to side as their teeth glow between the notes, and the caked blood crumbles from their jaws, flecking their pale throats as the song leaves them in fistfuls of smoke. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my house, I'm gonna let it shine. The pine needles spin and sputter around them in the minuscule wind made by their moving limbs. The cut under the tall boy's eye has reopened from his singing, and a black-red line now runs down his left ear, curving at his neck and vanishing in the ground. The small boy glances at his friend, the terrible bulb of an eye, and tries to forget. If you were God, you would tell them to stop clapping. You would tell them that the most useful thing one can do with empty hands is hold on. But you are not a god. You're a woman, a mother, and your son is lying under the pines while you sit at a kitchen table across town, waiting again. You have just reheated, for the third time, the pan of fried flat noodles and scallions. Your breath fogs the glass as you stare out the window, waiting for the boy's orange New York Knicks sweater to flash by, as he must be running, it being so late. But your son is still under the trees, beside the boy you will never meet. They are yards from the closed overpass, where a plastic bag thrashes against a chain link surrounded by hundreds of one-shot liquor bottles. The boys begin to shiver, their claps slow, nearly inaudible. Their voices subdued as the wind swarms hugely above them, needles clicking down like the hands of smashed watches. There are times, late at night, when your son would wake believing a bullet is lodged inside him. He'd feel it floating on the right side of his chest, just between the ribs. The bullet was always here, the boy thinks, older even than himself. And his bones, tendons, and veins had merely wrapped around the metal shard, sealing it inside him. It wasn't me, the boy thinks, who was inside my mother's womb, but this bullet, this seed I bloomed around. Even now, as a cold creeps in around him, he feels it poking out from his chest, slightly tenting his sweater. He feels for the protrusion, but as usual, finds nothing. It's receded, he thinks. It wants to stay inside me. It is nothing without me. Because a bullet without a body is a song without ears. Across town, facing the window, you consider reheating the noodles one more time. You sweep into your palm pieces of the paper napkin you had torn up, then get up to toss it out. You return to the chair, wait. That window, the same one your son had stopped at one night before coming in, the square of light falling across him as he watched your face, peering out at him. Evening had turned the glass into a mirror, and you couldn't see him there, only the lines scored across your cheeks and brow, a face somehow ravaged by stillness. The boy, he watches his mother watch nothing, his entire self inside the phantom oval of her face, invisible. The song long over, the cold, a numbing sheaf over their nerves. Under their clothes, goosebumps appear, making their thin, translucent hair rise, then bend against the fabric under their shirts. Hey, Trev, your son says, his friend's blood crusted tight on his cheek. Tell me a secret. Wind, pine needles, seconds. What kind? Just like a normal secret. It doesn't have to suck. A normal one. The hush of thinking. Steady breaths. The stars above them, a vast smudge on a hastily wiped chalkboard. Can you go first? On the table across town, your fingers stop drumming the formica. Okay. You ready? Yeah. You push back your chair, grab your keys, and walk out the door. I'm not scared of dying anymore. A pause. Then laughter. The cold, like river water, rises to their throats. Ma, you once told me that memory is a choice, but if you were God, you'd know it's a flood. Because I am your son, what I know of work, I know equally of loss. And what I know of both, I know of your hands. Their once supple contours I've never felt, the palms already calloused and blistered long before I was born, then ruined further from 3 decades in factories and nail salons. Your hands are hideous, and I hate everything that made them that way. I hate how they are the wreck and reckoning of a dream. How'd you come home, night after night, plop down on the couch and fall asleep inside a minute. I'd come back with your glass of water and you'd already be snoring, your hands in your lap like 2 partially scaled fish. What I know is that the nail salon is more than a place of work and workshop for beauty. It is also a place where our children are raised, a number of whom, like Cousin Victor, will get asthma from years of breathing the noxious fumes into their still developing lungs. The salon is also a kitchen where, in the back rooms, our women squat on the floor over huge woks that pop and sizzle over electric burners. Cauldrons of pho simmer and steam up the cramped spaces with aromas of cloves, cinnamon, ginger, mint, and cardamom mixing with formaldehyde, toluene, acetone, pine sol, and bleach. A place where folklore, rumors, tall tales, and jokes from the old country are told, expanded, laughter erupting in back rooms the size of rich people's closets, then quickly lulled into an eerie, untouched quiet. It's a makeshift classroom where we arrive, fresh off the boat, the plane, the depths, hoping the salon would be a temporary stop. Until we get on our feet, or rather, until our jaws soften around English syllables, bend over workbooks at manicure desks, finishing homework for nighttime ESL classes that cost a quarter of our wages. I won't stay here long, we might say. I'll get a real job soon. But more often than not, sometimes within months, even weeks, we will walk back into the shop, heads lowered, our manicure drills inside paper bags tucked under our arms, and ask for our jobs back. And often the owner, out of pity or understanding or both, will simply nod at an empty desk, for there is always an empty desk. Because no one stays long enough and someone is always just gone. Because there are no salaries, health care, or contracts. The body being the only material to work with and work from. Having nothing, it becomes its own contract, a testimony of presence. We will do this for decades, until our lungs can no longer breathe without swelling, our livers hardening with chemicals, our joints brittle and inflamed from arthritis, stringing together a kind of life. A new immigrant, within 2 years, will come to know that the salon is, in the end, a place where dreams become the calcified knowledge of what it means to be awake in American bones, with or without citizenship, aching, toxic, and underpaid. I hate and love your battered hands for what they can never be. It's Sunday. I'm 10. You open the salon door, and the acetone from yesterday's manicures immediately stings my nostrils. But our noses soon adjust, like they always do. You don't own the salon, but it's your task to run it each Sunday, the slowest day of the week. Inside, you switch on the lights, plug in the automated pedicure chairs, the water gurgling through pipes under the seats as I head to the break room to make instant coffee. You say my name without glancing up, and I know to walk over to the door, unlock it, flip the open sign back out to the street. That's when I see her, about 70, her hair white and wind-blown across a narrow face with mined-out blue eyes. She has the stare of someone who had gone beyond where she needed to go, but kept walking anyway. She peers into the shop, clutching a burgundy alligator purse with both hands. I open the door and she steps inside, hobbling a bit. The wind had blown her olive scarf off her neck, and it now hangs on one shoulder, brushing the floor. You stand, smile. "How I help you?" you ask in English. "A pedicure, please." Her voice is thin, as if cut with static. I help her out of her coat, hang it on the rack, and lead her to the pedicure chair as you run the air jets in the foot tub, fill the bubbling water with salts and solvents. The scent of synthetic lavender fills the room. I hold her arm and help her onto the seat. She smells of dried sweat mixed with the strong sweetness of drugstore perfume. Her wrist throbs in my grip as she lowers herself into the seat. She seems even frailer than she looks. Once she eases back into the leather chair, she turns to me. I can't hear her over the water jets, but can tell by her lips that she's saying thank you. When the jets are done, the water warm, in emerald green marbled with white suds, you ask her to lower her feet into the tub. She won't budge, her eyes closed. "Ma'am," you say. The salon, usually bustling with people or music or the TV with Oprah or the news, is now silent. Only the lights hum above us. After a moment, she opens her eyes, the blue ringed pink and wet, and bends over to fiddle with her right pant leg. I take a step back. Your stool creaks as you shift your weight, your gaze fixed on her fingers. The pale veins on her hands shiver as she rolls up her pant leg. The skin is glossy, as if dipped in a kiln. She reaches lower, grabs her ankle, and, with a jerk, detaches her entire lower leg at the knee. A prosthesis. Halfway down her shin bone, a brownish stub protrudes, smooth and round as the end of a baguette, or what it is, an amputated leg. I glance at you, hoping for an answer. Without skipping a beat, you take out your file and start to scrub her one foot, the puckered nub beside it shaking from the work. The woman places the prosthesis at her side, her arm resting protectively around its calf, then sits back, exhaling. "Thank you," she says again, louder, to the crown of your head. I sit on the carpet and wait for you to call for the hot towel from the warming case. Throughout the pedicure, the woman sways her head from side to side, eyes half closed. She moans with relief when you massage her one calf. When you finish, turning to me for the towel, she leans over, gestures toward her right leg, the nub hovering above the water, dry this whole time. She says, "Would you mind?" and coughs into her arm. "This one also, if it's not too much." She pauses, stares out the window, then down at her lap. Again, you say nothing, but turn almost imperceptibly to her right leg, run a measured caress along the nub's length, before cradling a handful of warm water over the tip, the thin streams crisscrossing the leathered skin. Water droplets. When you're almost done rinsing the soap off, she asks you, gently, almost pleading, to go lower. "If it's the same price anyway," she says, "I can still feel it down there. It's silly, but I can. You pause, a flicker across your face. Then, the crow's feet on your eyes only slightly starker, you wrap your fingers around the air where her calf should be, knead it as if it were fully there. You continue down her invisible foot, rub its bony upper side before cupping the heel with your other hand, pinching along the Achilles tendon, then stretching the stiff cords along the ankle's underside. When you turn to me once more, I run to fetch a towel from the case. Without a word, you slide the towel under the phantom limb, pad down the air, the muscle memory in your arms firing the familiar, efficient motions, revealing what's not there, the way a conductor's movements make the music somehow more real. Her foot dry, the woman straps on her prosthesis, rolls down her pant leg, and climbs off. I grab her coat and help her into it. You start walking over to the register when she stops you, places a folded $100 bill in your palm. "The Lord keep you," she says, eyes lowered, and hobbles out, the bell chime over the door clanging twice as it closes. You stand there, staring at nothing. Ben Franklin's face darkening in your still wet fingers, you slip the bill under your bra, not the register, then retie your hair. That night, belly down on the hardwood, your face resting on a pillow, you asked me to scrape your back. I knelt beside you, peeled your black t-shirt over your shoulders, unhooked your bra. Having done this hundreds of times by now, my hands moved on their own. As the bands fell away, you grabbed the bra, pulled it out from under you, and tossed it aside. Heavy with sweat from the day's work, it landed on the floor with the thud of a knee brace. The chemicals from the nail salon rose from your skin. I fished a quarter from my pocket, dipped it into the jar of Vicks vapor rub. The bright eucalyptus scent filled the air, and you started to relax. I dunked the coin, coating it with the greasy ointment, then dabbed a thumb swerve across your back, down your spine. When your skin shone, I placed the coin at the base of your neck and pulled it outward, across your shoulder blades. I scraped and re-scraped in firm, steady strokes, the way you taught me, until russet streaks rose from under the white flesh, the welts deepening into violet grains across your back like new, dark ribs, releasing the bad winds from your body. Through this careful bruising, you heal. I think of Bach again. A writer is someone who plays with the body of his mother, he says after the death of his own mother, in order to glorify it, to embellish it. How I want this to be true. And yet, even here, writing you, the physical fact of your body resists my moving it. Even in these sentences, I place my hands on your back and see how dark they are as they lie against the unchangeable white backdrop of your skin. Even now, I see the folds of your waist and hips as I knead out the tensions. The small bones along your spine, a row of ellipses no silence translates. Even after all these years, the contrast between our skin surprises me, the way a blank page does when my hand gripping a pen begins to move through its spatial field, trying to act upon its life without marring it. But by writing, I mar it. I change, embellish, and preserve you all at once. You groaned into the pillow as I pressed along your shoulders, then worked down through the stubborn knots. This is nice. This is so nice. After a while, your breathing deepened, evened out, your arms slack, and you were asleep. The summer I turned 14, I got my first job working tobacco on a farm outside Hartford. Most people don't realize tobacco can grow this far north, but put anything near water and it'll green itself into the height of a small army. Still, it's strange how some things come into practice. First cultivated by the agawam, broadleaf tobacco was soon planted by white settlers as a cash crop after they drove the natives off the land. And now it's harvested mostly by undocumented immigrants. I knew you wouldn't let me ride my bike the 8.5 miles out into the country, so I told you I was doing yard work for a church garden on the city outskirts. According to the flyer outside the local YMCA, the job paid $9 an hour, which was almost $2 above minimum wage at the time. And because I was still too young to be legally employed, I was paid under the table in cash. It was the summer of 2003, which meant Bush had already declared war on Iraq, citing weapons of mass destruction that never materialized. When the Black Eyed Peas' Where Is the Love played on every radio station, but especially on Power 98.6. And you could hear the song from nearly every car on the block if you slept with your windows open, its beats punctuated by the sound of beer bottles bursting on the basketball court across the street, the crackheads lobbing the empties up in the sky just to see how the street lights make broken things seem touched by magic, glass sprinkled like glitter on the pavement come morning. It was a summer Tiger Woods would go on to receive the PGA Player of the Year for the fifth time in a row, and the Marlins would upset the Yankees, not that I cared or understood. It was 2 years before Facebook and 4 before the first iPhone. Steve Jobs was still alive, and your nightmares had just started getting worse. And I'd find you at the kitchen table at some god-awful hour, butt naked, sweating, and counting your tips in order to buy a secret bunker just in case, you said. A terrorist attack happened in Hartford. It was the year the Pioneer 10 spacecraft sent its last signal to NASA before losing contact forever 7.6 billion miles from Earth. I got up at 6 in the morning 5 days a week and rode my bike the full hour it took to get to the farm, crossing the Connecticut River, past the suburbs with their suicidally pristine lawns, then into the sticks. As I approached the property, the fields unfolded all around me on both sides. The telephone wires slacked with the weight of crows dotted along the lines, the sporadic white almond trees in full bloom, irrigation ditches where more than a dozen rabbits would drown by summer's end, their corpses stinking the hot air. Verdant swaths of tobacco, some high as my shoulders, stretched so far that the trees standing at the farm's edge looked more like shrubs. In the middle of it all were three huge unpainted barns, all lined in a row. I rode up the dirt drive toward the first barn and walked my bike through the open door. As I adjusted to the cool dark, I saw a row of men sitting along the wall, their dark faces moving over paper plates of runny eggs, talking amongst themselves in Spanish. One of them, seeing me, waved me over, saying something I couldn't catch. When I told him I didn't speak Spanish, he seemed surprised. Then a flare of recognition flicked over him, and he lit up. Ah, he pointed at me and nodded. Chinito, Chinito. I decided, it being my first day, not to correct him. I gave him a thumbs up. Si, I said, smiling. Chinito. His name was Manny, he said, and gestured toward a table where a large sheet pan of sunny-side-up eggs sat over a butane heater beside a glass pot of room-temperature coffee. I settled among the men, eating in silence. Not counting myself, there were 22 other workers, most of them undocumented migrants from Mexico and Central America, save for one, Nico, who was from the Dominican Republic. There was also Rick, a white guy in his 20s from Colchester, who, it was said, was on the sex offender list, and tobacco was the only steady job he could get. Most were seasonal workers and followed various crops across the country as they ripened for harvest. At this farm, the men slept in an encampment comprising four trailers set a few yards behind the tree line at the edge of the property, hidden from the road. The barn rafters, where the picked tobacco was to be hung to dry, were now empty. By September's end, each barn would house almost 2 tons of tobacco, 2 times over. In between bites of runny eggs, I examined the structure. To encourage faster drying, every other wood panel on the barn siding was raised up, creating rib-like slits, allowing airflow, where the day's heat now ran its hot breath across my neck, carrying with it the sweet, bitter scent of tobacco and the iron of red dirt. The men, too, smelled of the fields. Before their boots met the soil, their bodies, even after morning showers, exuded the salt and sun-baked underscent from the previous day's work. Soon the same smell would permeate my own pores. A forest green Ford Bronco pulled into the drive. The men rose in unison and tossed their plates and cups into the wastebasket. They put on their gloves. Some poured water on rags and stuffed them under their caps. Mr. Buford walked in, a tall, lanky white man of about 70. He wore a Red Sox cap pulled low over a pair of aviators and a cheddar cheese grin. Hands on his hips, he reminded me of that maniac sergeant in full metal jacket, the one who got his brains blown out by one of his own privates for being an asshole. But Buford was cheery enough, charming even, if only a bit forced with it. He grinned, his one gold tooth sparking between his lips, and said, "How's my United Nations this morning? Bueno?" I walked up to him and introduced myself. I shook his hand, which was rough and chapped, which surprised me. He patted me on the shoulder and said, "I'll do fine as long as I just follow Manny, my crew leader." The men and I piled in the back of 3 pickups, and we drove out to the first field, where the crop was tallest, their heavy heads just starting to tilt. We were followed by 2 tractors, on which the plants would be loaded. By the time we got there, there was already a crew of 10 men crouched over the first 5 rows of tobacco. That was the cut team. Armed with machetes sharpened in the day's first light, they would set out 100 yards ahead of us and chop down the stalks in quick slashing sweeps. Sometimes, when we worked fast enough, we'd catch up to them, the sound of their blades louder and louder, until you could hear their lungs working as they cut, the stalks falling in bright green splashes around their hunched backs. You could hear the water inside the stems as the steel broke open the membranes, the ground darkening as the plants bled out. I was on the spear crew, where the shorter workers were. Our task was to pick up the fallen crop, their leaves already shriveled in the sun. We split into teams of 3 harvesters each, 2 pickers and 1 piercer. As a piercer, all you had to do was stand by the spearing horse, a cart with a removable spear attached to it, and run the plants through the spear until the plank filled up. Then you'd remove the spear tip, and one of the pickers would carry the full plank to an idling tractor, where a loader would rack the plank. The piercer would then take another plank from a holster, attach the steel spear tip, and continue filling the new rack. When the tractor was at capacity, it would be driven back to the barns, where dozens of men, usually the tallest ones, would pass the racks one by one to each other up the rafters to dry. Since you could fall from as high as 40 feet, the barn was the most dangerous place to work. There were stories the men told, from other farms, how the sound won't leave their ears, the thud of a body, someone humming or talking of the weather or complaining of a woman, the price of gas in Modesto, then the abrupt silence, the leaves shifting where the voice had been. That first day, I stupidly refused a pair of gloves offered by Manny. They were too big and ran nearly to my elbows. By 5 o'clock, my hands were so thick and black with sap, dirt, pebbles, and splinters, they resembled the bottom of a pan of burned rice. The crows floated over the field's wrinkled air as we worked the hours bare, their shadows swooping over the land like things falling from the sky. The jackrabbits dipped in and out of the rows, and once in a while a machete would come down on one, and you could hear, even through the clink of blades, the shrill yelp of a thing leaving the earth we stood on. But the work somehow sutured a fracture inside me, a work of unbreakable links and collaboration, each plant cut, picked, lifted, and carried from one container to another in such timely harmony that no stalk of tobacco, once taken from the soil, ever touches ground again. A work of myriad communications. I learned to speak to the men not with my tongue, which was useless there, but with smiles, hand gestures, even silences, hesitations. I made out people, verbs, abstractions, ideas with my fingers, my arms, and by drawing in the dirt. Manny, brow furrowed, his mustache almost gray from dried sweat, nodded as I cupped my hands into a blossom to indicate your name. Rose. The most common English word spoken in the nail salon was sorry. It was the one refrain for what it meant to work in the service of beauty. Again and again, I watched as manicurists bowed over a hand or foot of a client, some young as 7, say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so, so sorry," when they had done nothing wrong. I have seen workers, you included, apologize dozens of times throughout a 45-minute manicure, hoping to gain warm traction that would lead to the ultimate goal, a tip, only to say sorry anyway when none was given. In the nail salon, sorry is a tool one uses to pander until the word itself becomes currency. It no longer merely apologizes, but insists, reminds, I'm here, right here, beneath you. It is the lowering of oneself so that the client feels right, superior, and charitable. In the nail salon, one's definition of sorry is deranged into a new word entirely, one that's charged and reused as both power and defacement at once. Being sorry pays. Being sorry even, or especially, when one has no fault, is worth every self-deprecating syllable the mouth allows, because the mouth must eat. And yet, it's not only so in the nail salon, Ma. In those tobacco fields, too, we said it. Lo siento, Manny would utter as he walked across Mr. Buford's field of vision. Lo siento, Rigo whispered as he reached to place a machete back on the wall where Buford sat, ticking off numbers on a clipboard. Lo siento, I said to the boss after missing a day when Lan had another schizophrenic attack and had shoved all her clothes into the oven, saying she had to get rid of the evidence. Lo siento, we said when, one day, night arrived only to find the field half-harvested. The tractor, its blown-out engine, sitting in the still dark. Lo siento, señor, each of us said as we walked past the truck with Buford inside, blasting Hank Williams and staring at his withered crop, a palm-sized photo of Ronald Reagan taped to the dash. How the day after, we began work not with good morning, but with lo siento. The phrase with its sound of a boot step sinking, then lifted from mud. The slick muck of it wetting our tongues as we apologized ourselves back to making our living. Again and again, I write to you regretting my tongue. I think of those men who sweated, who joked and sang beside me in the endless tobacco. How George was one grand away, about 2 months of work, from buying his mother a house outside Guadalajara. How Brandon was going to send his 16-year-old daughter, Lucinda, to university in Mexico City to be a dentist, like she always wanted. How after one more season, Manny would be back by the seaside village in El Salvador, running his fingers over the scar on his mother's collarbone, where a tumor would have just been removed using the pay he received removing tobacco from the Connecticut soil. How he'd buy, with his remaining savings, a boat and try his luck fishing for marlins. Sorry, for these men was a passport to remain. The day's work done, my white tank top so stained with dirt and sweat, it was like I wore no shirt at all as I walked my bike out of the barn. Fingers sticky and raw over the handlebars, I plunged my silver huffy forward, down the dust-blown street, past the vast and now empty distances where the crop once stood, the sun burning low above the tree line. And I heard them behind me, their voices distinct as channels on a radio. Hasta mañana, chinito. Adios, muchacho. And I knew which men the voices belonged to. Without looking, I could tell Manny was waving, like he did each day, his 3.5-fingered hand black against the last light. What I wanted to say to them as I rode away, and also the next morning, all mornings, is what I want to say to you now. Sorry. Sorry that it would be so long before they would see their loved ones, that some might not make it back across the desert border alive, taken by dehydration and exposure, or murdered by drug cartels or the right-wing crack militia in Texas and Arizona. Lo siento, I wanted to say, but I couldn't, because by then my sorry had already changed into something else. It had become a portion of my own name, unutterable without fraudulence. Which is why, when the boy came to me one afternoon, the boy who would change what I knew of summer, how deep a season opens when you refuse to follow the days out of it, I said, sorry. The boy from whom I learned there was something even more brutal and total than work. Want. That August, in the fields, it was he who came into my vision. Near day's end, I felt another worker beside me, but, caught in the rhythm of the harvest, couldn't stop to consider him. We picked for about 10 minutes, his presence intensifying on the periphery until he stepped in front of me as I reached to lift a wilted stalk. I looked up at him, a head taller, his finely boned face dirt-streaked under a metal army helmet, tipped slightly backward, as if he had just walked out from one of Lon's stories and into my hour, somehow smiling. Trevor, he said, straightening up. I'm Trevor. I would know only later that he was Buford's grandson, working the farm to get away from his vodka-soaked old man. And because I am your son, I said sorry. Because I am your son, my apology had become, by then, an extension of myself. It was my hello. That first day after meeting him in the field, I found Trevor again in the barn. The dust light had washed the interior with a bluish glow. Outside, the workers' axes clinked against their belt straps as they climbed the dirt knoll back to their airstreams by the edge of the wood. The air was cool, tinged with chlorophyll from the fresh-cut tobacco now suspended from the beams above us, some still dripping, making tiny dust swirls along the barn floor. I don't know why I lingered at my bike, taking time checking the spokes. Trevor sat on a bench along the wall, chugging a neon yellow Gatorade. There was something about the way he looked when lost in thought. His brow pinched under squinted eyes, giving his boyish face the harsh, hurt expression of someone watching his favorite dog being put down too soon. The way his mud-streaked and dusty edges juxtapose against that rounded mouth and pert lips, sealed into a flush, feminine pout. Who are you? I thought to myself as I worked the brakes. What I felt then, however, was not desire, but the coiled charge of its possibility. A feeling that emitted, it seemed, its own gravity, holding me in place. The way he watched me back there in the field, when we worked briefly side by side, our arms brushing against each other as the plants racked themselves in a green blur before me, his eyes lingering, then flitting away when I caught them. I was seen. I who had seldom been seen by anyone. I who was taught by you to be invisible in order to be safe. Who, in elementary school, was sent to the 15-minute time out in the corner only to be found 2 hours later, when everyone was long gone and Mrs. Harding, eating lunch at her desk, peered over her macaroni salad and gasped, "My God, my God, I forgot you were still here. What are you still doing here?" Trevor and I talked about the fields as the light slipped from the barn. How much more there was to be done. How the crop was for cigars exported to Africa and East Asia, where smoking was still popular and where anything that came from America still had an aura of promise to it. But truth was, Trevor said, the crop was low grade, the burn bitter in the throat, sour. "This crop ain't even legit," he said. His voice echoed up the rafters. I peered over my shoulder, catching him. "Warm holes all over him. We got 2 good years, maybe 3, and then..." He ran his hand like a blade over his Adam's apple. "It's a wrap." We grew silent. I could feel his eyes as I returned to my bike. And I wanted it, for his gaze to fix me to the world I felt only halfway inside of. As I laid my chain on the fulcrum, I could hear the swishing of the Gatorade in the bottle, then the bottle being set down on the bench. After a moment, he said, real quiet, I fucking hate my dad. Up until then, I didn't think a white boy could hate anything about his life. I wanted to know him through and through by that very hate. Because that's what you give anyone who sees you, I thought. You take their hatred head on, and you cross it like a bridge to face them, to enter them. I hate my dad too, I said to my hands, now still and dark with chain grease. When I turned around, Trevor was smiling up at the ceiling. He saw me, hopped off the ledge and walked over, the smile fading into something else as he pulled the army helmet over his eyes. The black Adidas logo on his white t-shirt shifted as he approached. I was a freshman that summer, and Trevor was already a junior. Although barely visible in the sun, here in the barn, and coming closer, his thin mustache deepened, a blondish streak, dark with sweat. And above that, his eyes, their gray irises smattered with bits of brown and ember, so that, looking at them, you could almost see right behind you something burning under an overcast sky. It seemed the boy was always looking at a plane wrecking itself midair. That's what I saw that first day. And although I knew that nothing behind me was on fire, I turned back anyway and saw the coiled summer air sputtering with heat rise over the raised fields. The boy is 6 and wearing nothing but a pair of white underwear with Superman's patterned everywhere. You know this story. He has just finished crying and is now entering that state where his jaw shudders to calm itself shut. His snot-plastered nose, its salt on his lips, his tongue, he's at home. His mother, you remember this, has locked him in the basement for wetting his bed again. The 4 or 5 Supermans near his crotch now soiled dark. She had dragged him out of bed by the arm, then down the stairs as he screamed, begged, one more chance, Ma, one more chance. The kind of basement no one goes down. All around him, the dark scent of damp earth, rusted pipes choked with cobwebs, his own piss still wet down his leg, between his toes. He stands with one foot on the other, as if touching less of the basement meant he was less inside it. He closes his eyes. This is my superpower, he thinks, to make a dark even darker than what's around me. He stops crying. Summer was almost gone as we sat on the tool shed roof by the field's edge, but the heat had stayed, and our shirts clung to us like unmolted skins. The tin roof, touched all day by the heat, was still warm through my shorts. The sun, now waning, must still be stronger somewhere west, I thought, like in Ohio, golden yet for some boy I'll never meet. I thought of that boy, how far from me he was and still American. The wind was cool and thick up the legs of my shorts. We were talking, as we did those days after work when we were too exhausted to head home just yet. We talked about his guns, of school, how he might drop out, how the Colt factory in Windsor might be hiring again now that the latest shooting spree was 3 months done and already old news. We talked of the next game out on Xbox, his old man's drinking. We talked of sunflowers, how goofy they looked, like cartoons, Trevor said, but real. We talked about you, about your nightmares, your loosening mind, his face troubled as he listened, which made his pout more defined. A long silence. Then Trevor took out his cell phone, snapped a picture at the colors at the sky's end, then put it back in his pocket without reviewing what he took. Our eyes met. He flashed an embarrassed smile, then looked away and started picking at a pimple on his chin. Cleopatra, he said after a while. What? Cleopatra saw the same sunset. Ain't that crazy? Like everybody who was ever alive, only seen one sun. He gestured to indicate the whole town, even though we were the only people there, far as the eye could see. No wonder people used to think it was God himself. Said who? People. He chewed his lip for a moment. Sometimes I want to just go that way forever. He pointed his chin beyond the sycamores. Like just, psh. I studied his arm propped behind him. The thin, flowing muscles, field-toned and burger-fed, shifting as he talked. I flung the last rind from the grapefruit I was peeling off the roof. What about our skeletons? I wanted to ask. How do we get away from them? But thought better of it. It must suck to be the sun, though, I said, handing him a pink half. He put the whole half in his mouth.
Hubbub?
Finish chewing, you animal. He rolled back his eyes and bobbled his head playfully, as if possessed, the clear juice dripping down his chin, his neck, the indent under his Adam's apple, no larger than a thumbprint glistening. He swallowed, wiped his mouth with the back of his arm. How come? He repeated, serious. 'Cause you never see yourself if you're the sun. You don't even know where you are in the sky. I placed a wedge on my tongue, letting the acid sting the place where I'd bit the inside of my cheek all week for no reason. He looked at me thoughtfully, turned the idea in his head, his lips wet with juice. Like you don't even know if you're round or square, or even if you're ugly or not, I continued. I wanted it to sound important, urgent, but had no idea if I believed it. Like you can only see what you do to the earth, the colors and stuff, but not who you are. I glanced at him. He picked at a hole in his grass-stained white Vans. His nails scraped at the leather in the sneaker, the hole widening. I hadn't noticed until then the crickets chirping. The day dimmed around us. Trevor said, I think it sucks to be the sun because he's on fire. I heard what I thought was another cricket, a closer one. The throb, a thudded beating. But Trevor, still sitting, legs spread, had let his penis, soft and pink, hang out from the pant leg of his shorts, and was now pissing. The stream rattled on the slanted metal roof before falling off the side, dribbling onto the dirt below. And I'm putting out the fire, he said. His lips curled in concentration. I turned away, but kept seeing him. Not Trevor, but the boy in Ohio. The one who will soon be found by the hour I had just passed through, unscathed. Together, with nothing to say, we spat, one by one, the grapefruit seeds stored in our cheeks. They fell on the tin roof in big fat drops and blued as the sun sank fully behind the trees. One day, after overtime at the clock factory, the boy's mother came home to a house littered with hundreds of toy soldiers. Their curled plastic lives spread like debris across the kitchen tiles. The boy usually knew to clean up before she came home. But this day he was lost in the story he made of their bodies. The men were in the midst of saving a 6-inch Mickey Mouse trapped in a prison made of black VHS tapes. When the door opened, the boy leapt to his feet, but it was too late. Before he could make out his mother's face, the backhand blasted the side of his head, followed by another, then more. A rain of it, a storm of mother. The boy's grandmother, hearing the screams, rushed in and, as if by instinct, knelt on all fours over the boy, making a small and feeble house with her frame. Inside it, the boy curled into his clothes and waited for his mother to calm. Through his grandmother's trembling arms, he noticed the video cassettes had toppled over. Mickey Mouse was free. A few days after the shed roof, the grapefruit, I found myself sitting shotgun in Trevor's truck. He fished the black and mild from the chest pocket of his t-shirt, laid it gently across his kneecaps. Then he grabbed the box cutter from his other pocket and cut a lengthwise slit along the cigarillo before emptying its contents out the window. Open the glove, he said. Yeah, no, under the insurance. Yeah, right there. I grabbed the two dime bags, one half filled with weed, the other with coke, and handed them to him. He opened the bag, placed the weed, already broken, into the gutted cigarillo till it filled. He threw the bag out the window, then opened the second bag, tipped the white grains over the row of weed. Like snow-capped mountains, he said, grinning. In his excitement, he let the second bag fall through his legs to the floorboard. He licked the Black and Mild's hem, sealing the slit until it stuck into a tight joint, then blew on the hem, waved the joint in front of him to dry. He marveled at it between his fingers before placing it between his lips and lighting. We sat there, passing it back and forth until my head felt thin and skullless. After what seemed like hours, we ended up in the barn, somehow lying on the dusty floor. It must have been late, or at least dark enough to make the barn's interior feel immense, like the hull of a beached ship. Don't be weird, Trevor said, sitting up. He grabbed the World War II Army helmet off the floor and put it back on, the one he was wearing the day I met him. I keep seeing that helmet, but this can't be right. This boy, impossibly American and alive in the image of a dead soldier. It's too neat, so clean a symbol, I must have made it up. And even now, in all the pictures I look through, I can't find him wearing it. Yet here it is, tilted to hide Trevor's eyes, making him seem anonymous and easy to look at. I studied him like a new word, his reddish lips stuck out from the helmet's visor. The Adam's apple, oddly small, a blip in a line drawn by a tired artist. It was dark enough for my eyes to swallow all of him without ever seeing him clearly, like eating with the lights off. It's still nourished even if you didn't know where your body ends. Don't be weird. I wasn't looking at you, I said, diverting my gaze. I was just thinking. Look, the radio's working again. He played with the knob on the handheld radio in his lap, and the static intensified. Then a robust and urgent voice poured into the space between us.
Fourth down and goal with 27 seconds to go, and the Patriots line up.